News Radio Studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Everyone, so glad you're there. Hope you had a fantastic weekend. We're back in action now. Michael Murkowski will be joining us shortly. He is the president and CEO of the Jewish Institute for the National Security of America. How does he feel about the now new detente between Lebanon and Israel and Hezbollah? Violated it already. Lawrence Jones in studio, fresh off Fox and Friends. He said, Brian, I can't get enough of you. We're having such a good time. Can I join right now? I said, all right, Lawrence. Just every Monday for the rest of your career, if that's okay. So before we get to Lawrence and we talk about your weekend, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
100% of Virginians want election results to be respected. We're deeply worried that Donald Trump will try to interfere with the election results this November or in 2028 because we saw him do it before.
Oh, so ridiculous. That is Tim Kaine, gerrymandering mania over 1 million early voters have cast their ballot already in Virginia's vote referendum tomorrow, whether to redistrict and make it almost solid blue. We'll talk about what it means.
Number two.
I'm actually happy to tell you that that pied-à-terre tax, that is an agreement that we have to tax the wealthy. I always said that I believed in the importance of taxing the rich. This is taxing the rich.
Yes, proud socialists, despite the rockiest of starts, a $5.4 billion deficit for the socialists, and he does not care. He thinks he's right on target. He is not backing down, and he says, I will not modify my socialistic ways.
Number one.
Anybody who has dealt with the Iranians will tell you it is often two steps forward, three steps back. They're incredibly slippery. They can't be trusted.
Yep, that is true. Ambassador Waltz, back to war. Iran's hardliners take over as VP Vance heads to Pakistan. Still not sure if Iran will even show up with an 18-hour flight in the balance. Why is he going unless they're guaranteed of this? To me, Lawrence, I think we're going back to war. That's where I think we're heading. Unless the Iranians back off, the president wants he's going to have to finish the job.
The IRGC is out of control right now. It doesn't seem like the government has any control over them. You know, I go back and forth on this, Brian. Are we wasting our time talking to them, or are we giving our troops enough time to rest, refuel, get more of our aircraft carriers, the maintenance work done on that.
Assess the damage.
Assess the damage. Kind of look what they're doing on the ground and all that. That's where I'm at right now. I mean, I admire the president's, you know, stomach for peace and want to do that. But these guys aren't being serious. They're wasting time.
Right. So a couple of things. According to the Institute for Study of War, which I love, the IRC commander, Major General Ahmed Vahidi, and members of his inner circle have allegedly taken charge of the Islamic Republic, as evidenced by Tehran's attacks on ships trying to sail through the strait. Tehran's refusal to join peace talks with the U.S. this week, and the Washington-based Institute for the Study of War claims that the foreign minister has essentially been sidelined. And the foreign minister said he wanted to do a complete deal, like a major deal, everything decided on. Uranium gone, nuclear program, Strait of Hormuz, relief on sanction relief, all that was going to be done all at once.
Well, that was clear based on Friday when the foreign minister puts out the statement saying that the strait is now open, right, from their side. I mean, we still had a blockade. And then the moment that they say that, the IRGC releases their own statement saying, no, it's not. We still have complete control of it. So it looks like, you know, as we kind of figure that the more moderates, it's kind of hard to be a moderate radical, but we'll, just for the purpose of this conversation, the moderates are part of this coalition are within the government. The IRGC, the people with the weapons, the ones that have all the missiles, the drones and all of that, they're staying with it.
So now the president said, if, for example, in a scenario, the vice president, Steve Witkoff, Jared Kushner arrive in Pakistan.
Waste of time.
And they don't show.
Embarrassing. Propaganda winning.
So it's Tuesday's the end of the ceasefire. Why would anyone so far, if you don't show, that means you don't care if the ceasefire is over. Now, the markets will hate it. And obviously, it's going to be more pain for the Iranians, for the Chinese, especially because the Chinese aren't going to get any oil in or out. So no oil is coming in and out. So why would they do? One thing that'll happen, Gulf State's got to be ready. Hopefully they got more interceptors and they're ready to go. But I want you to hear from on this week with George Stephanopoulos, which he's never on. This is their ambassador, the UAE ambassador to the U.S., Raheem Al-Hashimi, cut 8.
For us, it's very clear that they've chosen to go down this path because we are everything that they're not. We're a model of economic prosperity. We have 200 nationalities that live there. We have religions and cultures from all around the world. We used our oil wealth to build an economic powerhouse. They used their wealth for nuclear programs that are nefarious, for missiles, drones, proxies, etc. So whereas we tried to become and have become an international, global, responsible player, they are a pariah state. And they wanted to break that model, but they underestimated our resolve.
Right, because they knocked down over 80% of the 2,600 rockets and drones shot at them.
That was such a great statement by her. And just to expand on it, the part that she wasn't comfortable going further was saying, The Gulf states, most of them, chose economic prosperity over radical Islamic terror. That's the reason why Iran is upset with them. And the Iranians believe that the Gulf states sold out. They picked the economic prosperity over religion. And so now that's why they're being targeted, because they knew all along privately that the Gulf states thought that Iran was a problem.
Yeah, so the UAE says we're going to need an economic lifeline. I could not picture this country, which seemed awash in cash. Evidently, they need a bit of a bailout from us, like similar to it seemingly we actually did with Argentina. They said through dollars they wanted to extend some type of credit. Now, that shows me the natural gas fields must have been really damaged.
Oh, yeah.
Because that is such a – not only that, they can't export it.
Well, and that's what they were trying to target to begin with. They were trying to cripple these Gulf states economically. But again, to your point about Argentina paid that back.
Yeah.
They paid it back. And we already have business relationships with them anyway, so we might as well do this deal. I think it's great for us and our relationship. You know, in the Middle East, we only used to have truly Israel. If we get all the Gulf states, which I think this president has been able to achieve, then do you realize for generations what's going to happen in the Middle East? We never have to be just a fly on the wall anymore. We have partners now to watch it for us.
So the UAE has held talks with the U.S. about securing a potential financial backstop. The UAE central bank governor discussed a possible currency swap line with the U.S. Treasury and Federal Reserve. A swap line would give the UAE access to U.S. dollars to stabilize its currency and financial system during the crisis. They say if we don't do that for them, UAE warned it might use the Chinese yen or other currency for oil trade in dollars if dollar access tightens.
Can't happen. Can't push them into the arms of China. We got to do what we can. Now, I will say the one thing we haven't talked about, Brian, that I'm a little skeptical of, you may feel differently, is Pakistan. Now, I know that the president has a good relationship. I don't tend to trust them. I don't like the way that they have handled this, in a sense. I mean, they're essentially taking Iranian side this morning, saying that we need to open up the strait, advising the president to do that. Why would we do that? It's the first time we've seen the real economic pressure. You know, we were taking out their leaders left and right, going after their Navy left and right, going after their uranium, and it wounded them from a, you know, I guess, physical standpoint, but it wasn't economically messing with their mind. Their money has started to mess with their mind, and the Pakistanis are telling us to open that back up for them? No way.
You know, the theory is, since Iran opened up the strait on their end, they say America should open up the blockade on our end. So that would also allow them to be able to cash in on the oil coming in and out.
Right.
And lengthen this. But I think the president could say, if you want, these couple of two things have to be agreed upon while my guys are in the air.
Right.
If you want that blockade release, you got to do, number one, get out of the strait immediately. Or number two, tell me the framework for us to reclaim the 1,000 pounds of uranium.
Yeah, but Brian, also to that point, though, I don't think you put the vice president on a plane. You can't, not under these conditions.
But do you believe the foreign minister is telling him we're meeting? And do you think the IRGC is saying we're not?
I don't think they're on the same page. And when they're not on the same page, real decisions, it doesn't have any backing. The deal is moot if they're not on the same page. Because the foreign minister and whoever's in charge of the government, de facto government right now, can come to any sort of agreement, but it's not going to be honored by the IRGC. So why even go to the meeting? Until they're on the same page, I say we don't get on a plane.
Yeah, the one thing about the Pakistanis that gives me a little bit more trust than you have, they're tight with the Saudis. And if anyone is as angry at Iran as we are, it's the Saudis. So the Saudis kind of put them up to and said, why don't you guys offer your services to be the place? You know, obviously they're not going to go to Riyadh.
Right.
So it would have been easier to go to Europe.
Right.
But for the foreign minister of Iran, with what basically in the middle of a no-fly zone, that might be somewhat of an issue. So I guess we'll see where it goes. I do want to get you to weigh in on Zohram Mamdani and what he says about democratic socialism 100 days in, cut 13.
Now that you've bumped up against the hard realities of a $5.4 billion budget shortfall and the other red tape that you have to go through, do you still believe in democratic socialism? Do you still think it can be effective?
I believe in it even more than I did the day before. And that's because of the fact that it is focused on the needs of working people. And working people need that focus, that fight from politicians more than ever.
He's good at messaging. It's going to be terrible for the city, terrible for the country, but the voters have an appetite for it because people are suffering. I will say this, Barack Obama coming to New York City and them opening a preschool on a weekend. I mean, who sends their kids to preschool on a weekend? Tells you it was all staged and everything like that. Democratic socialism is now the mainstream position of the Democratic Party. You can't just say that's just the crazy loons, the crazy Bernie, AOC squad. The squad is the leader now. Bernie is the leader now. And Barack Obama essentially coming here, meeting with him. Yes, he agrees. And he is your leader. He is your leader.
So I'm shocked.
I'm not shocked. And me and you had this conversation this morning. Barack Obama always had these points of view. That's why you had Bill Ayers. He was a commuter organizer. He's always been more progressive, but he's smart. He realized that, look, you can't have these radical positions and become president of the United States, at least back in 2028. But right now, it's a different country, and they're accepting of these viewpoints.
But you remember, he backed Hillary Clinton. It was considered a moderate compared to this. And then 2020, he said, oh, my goodness, Bernie Sanders could win. Quickly go get Joe.
Yes.
And tell everybody else to back off.
Yes.
So he didn't say go get Bernie.
No, it was a different country, a different time. And you're right. They didn't want Bernie because the country didn't want him. There wasn't a large population. I mean, Bernie's always had this little crazy crowd. But this is different now. This is like even where these are supposed to be moderate areas that are accepting democratic social. I mean, take Michigan, a swing state. President DJT wins this state, and this nutcase who is afraid of of offending his community could possibly win that state. Now, we hope Mike Rogers pulls it off. He was very close in the last election. But this guy's in the mainstream. Everyone is taking him seriously. That didn't used to be the case.
Hassan Piker, as radical as he gets with millions of followers, but believes that we deserve 9/11.
Right.
He says he would vote for Hamas over any Republican.
Right.
Said Rick Scott should be killed.
Yeah.
Because of
doesn't
his
care
views
about
on
what happened. That women got raped during October 7th. He said, don't even bring it up.
Yeah.
Don't even bring it up to him. Now, every Democrat that wants to be, you know, taken seriously in the mainstream, apparently on the left side, they got to stop by and do his podcast. He's like the Joe Rogan for the left.
Although I did see that Cory Booker denounced him.
Oh, great.
So, but I know that Al Sayed is appearing with him, and Ro Khanna went up to one on his podcast.
Yeah, because this guy is controlling the narrative right now. I will say this. They got one shot at this, these Democratic Socialists. And I'm willing to, I think we need to have this debate so we can beat the crap out of it and then end it once and all. But I think the next Democratic candidate for president is going to be your Democratic Socialist candidate. I don't think you're going to get a moderate in this next primary.
And if he's close, that'll be scary.
No.
Just like, for example, if that rat, like a Nick Fuentes type person started emerging on the right, winning primaries. I would say scary.
You were right. 100%. But Brian, I just think that there hasn't been enough. I mean, we know this because we talk about it all the time. Enough education about the dangers of socialism. You know, they don't teach in school about Cuba and Venezuela. They don't teach any of, or Colombia, what's going on there. They don't. They talk about it in glowing fashion. And think about it. There's an attempt to make America look like the UK. We have radicals just roaming the street.
Yeah.
So I think we're in real trouble right now, and it does us no favor. Does us no favor to say, oh no, no, it's just a little wing of the Democrat. No, no, no. They're the mainstream right now.
Well, you did a great job. Did you enjoy your
live PD?
Live PD.
It was great. By the way, Dan Abrams loves you. Oh,
really?
My God. He goes, how's it been with Brian Kemp? He's always fair. He called you fair, which is, that's a compliment.
On camera?
Yeah.
Oh?
Yeah, he called you fair.
Oh, so they acknowledge you were from Fox. They didn't just put you in as an expert.
They acknowledge I was from Fox, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. So,
because you got this law enforcement background. I mean,
I trained the canines. So, gave me an opportunity to, you know, quarterback what's going on out there. It was a real fun time, you know, and, you know, it's big.
It's good to do something different, too.
It's something different, exactly.
So. Yeah, I think it's a great idea. It is like the red zone.
Exactly.
It's like the red zone of football, but it's
exactly.
The red zone of law enforcement.
That's exactly right. And it's like, you know, we talk about politics and all this type of stuff all day, but this gives us an opportunity to quarterback what's going on with the men and women in blue.
All right. Hey, Lawrence, thanks so much for coming
up. Thanks, BK.
All right. Talk to you soon. Back.
Keeping you informed, engaged, and always a step ahead. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
This tax will raise at least $500 million directly for the city. It'll help fund things like free childcare, cleaner streets, safer neighborhoods. As mayor, I believe everyone has a role to play in contributing to our city. And some, a little bit more than others. Happy Tax Day, New York.
No, you shouldn't be. You know, realize, I already told you already, that the top 20% in this country pay 87% of the taxes. And instead of cutting back social programs and spending, they want to bring up social programs and continue to tax you, the so-called wealthy. And believe me, this spreads all the way down. Because if you're taxing me 87%, I don't stay. That means less jobs. That means less money to pull from. That means you up taxes even more. So it's going to make it impossible to live. I can't believe more people haven't done the economic capitalistic math. And for people who say, well, you need social programs, of course you do. Of course you need property taxes to fund schools. Of course you need things to build money to build roads. But in proportion of the income, don't just because people are wealthy, don't think they're going to work 70 hours a week in order to give more of their money to a pool that's wasting it. Places overrun with fraud. You know that. They just pointed to so-called free preschool. They have 28 open buildings that have a cost of $100 million wasted because people have not organized the preschools that were supposed to be free.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With a message for everyone paying big wireless way too much. Please, for the love of everything good in this world, stop. With Mint, you can get premium wireless for just $15 a month. Of course, if you enjoy overpaying, no judgments, but that's weird. Okay, one judgment. Anyway, give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan equivalent to $15 per month required. Intro rate first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See full terms at mintmobile.com.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Iran needs to give up its interference with the freedom of navigation through the Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz, give up the effort to try to turn that into a Panama Canal in which they can charge tolls of $2 million per ship. And also, I think we need to be a bit cautious about what Lebanon can do with Hezbollah. Absolutely the right policies to encourage them to help their military strengthened to be able to take on Hezbollah more and more. But I think that's the one where there are some limitations on what realistically can be achieved.
Right, because they are like a cancer living in Lebanon, and Lebanon didn't ask for it. What was done earlier that they came here could be debating some other time and maybe some academic circles. But Iran wants that influence on the doorstep of Israel. So that's why they wanted the ceasefire before talks. And I don't think it's that big of a deal, because, you know, if they start hitting Israel again, and I think they did, they killed evidently a UN worker of French descent or soldier over the weekend. So I think there was an attack again. So how long this is going to last, I am not sure. I love the fact that Israel is talking to Lebanon then, because I think they have very similar goals, I would assume. Michael Makovsky joins us now, president and CEO of the Jewish Institute for National Security of America and a leading Washington, D.C.-based policy and educational organization focused on U.S. defense and national security as well. Michael, your thoughts about where we're at with the ceasefire that exists right now in Israel?
Yeah, the one with Hezbollah.
Yep.
Yeah, look, I agree with you. Hezbollah's a cancer, as you just said. I think it's, you know, it's tenuous. The Israelis, you know, were rather ambivalent about it. I think it was more about the way it was done, because it was kind of seen as the U.S. pressuring Israel to do it to facilitate U.S.-Iranian talks, and the Israelis didn't want to concede to the Iranians that they could have any influence on this sector beyond what they have. Look, I think the only way that conflict is going to be really resolved, I think, is really if Iran is weakened, because if that regime in Tehran collapses, obviously then Hezbollah is pretty much finished. But until that happens, I think this thing's going to simmer.
That's the problem with releasing the sanctions. So if you get rid of the sanctions relief in terms for air quotes, them getting rid of their nuclear program and deciding and pledging not to, they're going to get that money. And they've already shown what they do with money when they get it. They give it to these outlaw groups.
100%. And I agree. But and it's also a case. It's also a problem with Tehran, because this regime is, I think, teetering in Tehran. And we can't take our a boot off their neck, so to speak. And we also, I think, need to make sure we recognize that the Iranian people are our major ally here. And if we give any economic relief to the Iranian regime, it will strengthen the regime and demoralize the people. Mm-hmm. And I think the ultimate verdict on this war is going to be whether the Iranian people rise up again against the regime. So we don't want to discourage that in any way. We don't want to do anything that provides an economic lifeline to this regime.
So they did a poll. The Washington Post did a poll about U.S.-Iran tensions. They said, who do you sympathize with when it comes to Israel and the Palestinians? 50-50. 50% sympathize with the Israelis. 50% sympathize with the Palestinians. I can't believe it. For the GOP, 81% are for Israel. For the Dems, only 25% are for Israel. So that's the new reality.
It is. It's really upsetting. It's very upsetting. And I think on the left, which, as you point out, is overwhelmingly, it's moved a lot against Israel. I think it's part of a larger trend we're seeing on the left that's frankly just anti-American. And I think it's part of that as well. And I think that's a very disconcerting trend we have in the United States.
For Gen Zers, 26% support Israel, 74% support the Palestinians.
Absolutely.
So I'll tell you what. When you see all those votes go for cutting off aid to the Israelis, you know that if a Democrat gets elected, Israel is going to have to almost fend for themselves.
Right. Look, we see this not my area so much, but the Democratic embrace of Sam Piker. You know, and this is a guy who's not only anti-Israel, but he's anti-American.
He says we deserve 9/11.
Exactly. So I see that on the left. I see a lot of this as a trend. The anti-Israel trend is part of an anti-America trend. So I think it's larger than Israel.
I hear you. So And by the way, a lot of people just aren't educated. They have no idea about the history of Israel. They have no idea our role in that. They have no idea the difference between a democracy and what the Palestinians are. They deserve their own homeland. Do they know what they've done when they had the opportunity to have a homeland? How many times they kicked it to the curb or ignored it or just focused on terror? So you have no, they just have no interest in learning anything about it. So let's go back to the U.S. and Iran. Why would J.D. Vance be flying to Pakistan unless the Iranians had committed to talks?
It's a good question. I don't know exactly. I think, there are mixed messages coming out of Iran. Obviously, they're saying now they're not sure. Don't forget the last time Vance went to Pakistan the other week, the Iranians were also playing games. So it's a little unclear if they're just trying to extract some concessions from the United States, but it'd obviously be a big mistake for the Iranians not to embrace this opportunity.
Michael, the ceasefire ends tomorrow. And if you don't show up tonight, you're telling me you don't care if the ceasefire starts again. So we know what the Israelis know about every one of these men and where they live and who they are and where they travel to and the blocks they're on right now and the cars they drive. So if you want to go back to that, that's in the cards. Mohammed Bagdar Gabalov is the speaker of the mostly show parliament that they have. He is now leading the negotiations, some say. Here's what he said yesterday, cut three.
Our dear people, the Strait is under the control of the Islamic Republic. Do you remember that they wanted to send minesweepers and clear the mines? Well, we stood firm against them and confronted them. We considered this a violation of the ceasefire, and we said that if you take this action, we will strike. We even went to the stage of clash, and they retreated.
So they think they won. They are trying to tell their people this propaganda story. So they blocked the strait. We blockaded the strait. They shut it. So one way or another, nothing's getting in. And guess what? They're the ones who need the money, the revenue, the oil to go in and out. They're the ones who need the fertilizer to go in and out and iron to move. So they ultimately cannot hold out for long.
Right. Not to mention the 40 days of bombing of almost 25,000 targets that Israel and the United States conducted. So they're in bad shape. The regime is in terrible shape. I don't think President Trump is going to make a bad deal. My own personal preference would be really no deal at all, really, because I don't trust anything the Iranians say. And so they might commit to something that, to me, it's meaningless. The ceasefire, they violated it immediately, so 2 weeks ago. So my own preference would be, unless the Iranians completely capitulate to American demands of extracting the uranium, the enriched uranium outside Iran, complete access to all the nuclear facilities, opening up Hormuz, and so on. Unless they agree to all that, I'd rather we continue the war a little longer to weaken the regime even more. Whatever we could do on the nuclear front, the ballistic missile front, we should do. And then we just say, okay, we've done enough, and now we have to turn it over to the Iranian people, and we're going to monitor the regime. And I think that's probably, to me, a better course, unless President Trump is able to get them to completely capitulate. I personally am skeptical about that.
Me too. So you think that we just got to finish it off and then lay the groundwork for the Iranians to take back their country and somehow get them guns? Because you could be as brave as you want, but you can't stop a bullet.
Look, the Iranian, I think what President Trump said, I think it was like 1 a.m. Eastern time when this war began on February 28th. He says this is basically a once-in-a-generation opportunity for the Iranian people. They showed tremendous courage in early January, and the regime responded by massacring, tens of thousands of them, imprisoning, torturing, and said it's terrible. We need to remember they're our key partner here. So we want to do whatever we can to create the conditions for the regime collapse. We've done that. But we just, I think, need to go just a little further. We got to do nothing to give a lifeline to this regime.
I know that it's impossible to say there's a moderate on the Iranian side. We've learned that. But there is a difference between the IRGC and some foreign minister, the president, difference. So Karim Saggiopour was on This Week with George Stephanopoulos. He's a senior fellow and says the Iranians are signaling it's time to compromise. Some are, some aren't. Listen to this. Cut seven.
Well, I think we've started a debate within Tehran between those who want to continue to resist the United States and do not trust the United States and those who argue, listen, we've prevailed. This was a war of regime change for the United States. We've survived. Let's consolidate our gains now. And the Speaker of Parliament in Tehran, Qalibov, was trying to make the case to people that we've survived, we've prevailed, now is the time for compromise.
So who's going to win? Who's going to win that debate?
The guys with the guns, and that's the Islamic Revolutionary Guard. So it's hard to call the Speaker of the Parliament, who's awful, a relative moderate. But I can understand why he and the president might want to cut a deal. But it's ultimately the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guards, that are going to be making a decision. And I think their view is they could weather. The key is survival of the regime. And that's so they just think, you know, and I don't think they're not going to give up their nuclear program. At least I'd be highly surprised if they do. And they just feel they'll weather the storm. And they're the ones that are going to make the decisions.
And what's the feeling in Israel right now?
I think they want to go further. The ceasefire was not popular in Israel. It was seen as done under, you know, of course, anything that it's a little like Trump, anything Netanyahu does, at least half the country thinks is terrible. He could say up, everyone would say down. So it's a little like here with Trump. So, but any prime minister of Israel would have acceded to President Trump's, demands there. But I think the Israeli public, who's endured a lot, you know, it's imagine having to go in safe rooms and in shelters constantly because of sirens from missiles. But despite that, I think the people just want to finish the job. They don't want to deal with Iran anymore. And by the way, our Arab allies, the Emiratis and so on, they don't either. So I think what the our regional allies are fearful of is a regime that survives and is out for revenge.
I just worry about the interceptors and the defensive drones. You know, we go on. I know we don't have a bottomless pit of weaponry, and we have a lot of people that are being hit, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's true, and that's a concern. Absolutely, you're right about that. But, I think the big question strategically is the nuclear sites. There, it's the enriched uranium, and it's the sites that we think not only where the uranium might be, but also that weren't hit before. There's a site called Pickaxe Mountain. It's more buried than Fordo. It was not hit in the 12-day war last June because it is more deeply buried. There's another site that I think was at least not publicly known until recently in Isfahan. We have to have access to all that. So I think the president has to make a decision. And we have, I believe, my understanding is we have a military plan to access these sites and the enriched uranium. It's risky for reasons you could understand because we'd have to place special forces, as have a secure perimeter and so on, which isn't easy to do inside Iran. But if that is seen as too risky to do now, then we're just going to have to monitor and then I think pivot to really weakening the regime in every way, because ultimately, if this regime collapses, all our other problems really go away. The nuclear, Hormuz, everything.
Proxies. Yeah, it's amazing how much is fixed if Iran falls apart.
Right.
And they rebuild just to be a normal nation. And they'll be a very rich nation, too, with all the assets that they have. Michael Makovsky, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, and have a good day.
You too. And I also think that we've already changed. The oil and gas business is already looking for other areas to drill, other areas to explore, because they want to get away from the Middle East, away from the Strait, and then be able to service customers as a reliable partner. Because we are reliable, oil and gas, economically, we are. But when we come back, why Canada is going away from us. And the leader there is actually gaining in popularity because he is. Don't move.
Big guests, bold opinions, better information. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Anybody who has dealt with the Iranians will tell you it is often two steps forward, three steps back. They're incredibly slippery. They can't be trusted. They cheated over the years, which is one of the reasons that President Trump withdrew us from the JCPOA. They were hiding sites. They were hiding capabilities. And this is why he made the bold decision last year in Operation Midnight Hammer to just end it. Once and for all. And again, we have to take the perspective that we're not waiting, we're not trusting. We are reducing their capabilities, their military's in shambles, their missile program is in shambles, and now, hopefully, diplomatically, they will do it the easy way rather than the hard way of finally giving up on this illegal ambition.
So that is Ambassador Michael Walls, one of the most qualified ambassadors we ever had, the United Nations, which, believe it or not, is leaning towards in almost every resolution condemning Iran. Can you believe this? Outside, of course, Russia and China, but the rest of the Arab world is condemning Iran. Outside, maybe Turkey, but Turkey's not happy. They were rocketed, too. They were targeted. Just shows you how discoordinated they are. But here's where we stand. Yesterday, as you probably know, we told a ship to stop. They didn't. So they warned them, get out of the engine room. They blew up the engine room. They boarded and used fast rope right onto the ship. And it was a ship that was heading to China. So we told the Iranians, we turned around 20 ships and we sent around. We have that one right now in our midst. Now, they have said this morning they are threatening retaliation for doing this. Really? Do you really want to retaliate? What do they have is a mosquito navy. So when the president says the navy's been destroyed, yeah, they're bulked up, normal-sized navy, but they got these fast boats, some of which are droned, which just means they run automatically, all bombs. They could do some damage. Think about the USS Cole. You have one of those dinghies. If people want to give up their lives, they used to just explode it right into the hull of the ship, and then you could take down that ship. You could certainly hurt a lot of sailors would happen. So we're at a standstill now. This is everything's coming to a head. What I'm happy is the markets aren't overreacting. Slightly up. We're at 49,000. I also like that oil is only slightly up. Maybe it's at, instead of $81, it's $86. And there's been a massive push. For example, Saudi Arabia's going using the Red Sea with a lot of their exports now, and they're utilizing their pipelines to get now down to back to 15 million barrels a day. That's going to continue. So I think we got to get rid of the Strait of Hormuz as a major focal point the best you can. And number two, I think we got to get ready to go for a complete victory. I know it's going to be economic pain and political pain for the president, but he's already done some extraordinary things. Finish the job. Do us on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Go to BrianKilmeade.com. Find out how to see me in Reno on stage May 30th for History, Liberty, and Laughs.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. We're here at 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country and around the world. Happy to be here where it feels like winter again. It was a bit of a reprieve over the weekend, but in the Northeast, it got cold. I guess we should handle it, suck it up. At least we turned the corner. It can't get that much colder after our brutal winter, but we're back in action now. Michael Goodwin is standing by at the New York Post. I got to talk to him about Mondami sat down and meet the press to talk about his love of socialism. A little bit later, Congressman Brandon Gill, one of the most talented people in Congress. We'll talk about what's going to be happening in the next few months. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
100% of Virginians want election results to be respected. We're deeply worried that Donald Trump will try to interfere with the election results this November or in 2028 because we saw him do it before.
You're just a clown. Senator Tim Kaine just weighing in to foment unrest. When we try to crack down on election integrity as a country, he says Donald Trump messing with elections. You mean like last time when he actually won the popular vote and the Electoral College? Gerrymandering mania. Over 1 million early voters have cast their ballot ahead of Virginia's vote tomorrow on gerrymandering to make it a total blue state. What's at stake? Power in the House.
Number two.
I'm actually happy to tell you that pied de terre tax, that is an agreement that we have to tax the wealthy. I always said that I believed in the importance of taxing the rich. This is taxing the rich.
Yes, congratulations. Everything that capitalism is not about. Proud socialist, despite the rockiest of starts and a $5 billion budget deficit, the socialist mayor of New York is not backing off or modifying his socialist ways. When will the Dems do it?
Number one.
Anybody who has dealt with the Iranians will tell you it is often two steps forward, three steps back. They're incredibly slippery. They can't be trusted.
That is Ambassador Michael Waltz. Back to war. Iran's hardliners take over as VP looming. The VP Vance is heading up a delegation to Pakistan to meet with the Iranians. The problem is the Iranians might not show. How embarrassing. It means essentially you want war because the ceasefire will be over. Let's bring in Michael Goodwin of the New York Post. Michael, there's no other way to interpret it. If you don't show up for the last day of talks one day before the ceasefire ends, you want to go back to war, right?
Yeah, that, I think you're right, Brian. That's the only way to see that situation. And look, I think it bears worth repeating that this is an Islamist cult, effectively. And what they've done to their own country, their own people, it shouldn't surprise the world that it has only contempt for everybody else.
Well, do you think the president is up against it economically because of the price of gas and, you know, affordability being a real issue, number one? And number two, we have the War Powers Act, and we had a bunch of people in Congress and House that wanted to deny the president the ability to prosecute a war.
Yeah, look, I think the president has been consistent in wanting to end the ceasefire. I think it looked to me over the weekend as though it might hold, because I thought perhaps the Iranians had at least seen a way to stop the one-sided bombardment, but apparently not. Apparently they want more of it and are willing to test Trump's patience. So I think they're making a mistake, because I think the president can't leave now without a victory, that clear victory having to do with the nuclear material and the Strait of Hormuz. I think those now are the two big things on the table.
Michael Goodwin, I think you're 100% right, but do you realize the upside in what you just said? If he walks out of a war that many people say, well, he broke his word about foreign wars, and I don't feel that way, but we could debate that a separate time. But if it culminates with us getting 1,000 pounds of uranium out, they stop pursuing a nuclear program, they open up the Strait of Hormuz and stop funding their proxies, if that happens, and of course, enforcement mechanism will have to be put in place, and this foreign war becomes a foreign win. Man, you talk about momentum with gas prices and oil prices dropping at the same time. That is a victory along with Venezuela, don't you think?
Absolutely. And look, the whole Mideast would be realigned if Iran is no longer a threat to Israel or to the Arab states. So you have a whole different world coming out of it than you had going into a much, much better, safer, and more prosperous world. I mean, that would be an amazing event. But the Iranians have to wise up that I think there's very little chance of Trump walking away without that conclusion.
Exactly. He knows what winning looks like. And he knows there's certain things that can't be spun. We're all going to make our own judgment. So
right.
when you talk about things that have changed in the Middle East, Michael, you covered 9/11, you've been here forever, and now you talk about the different attitude in the Middle East. Case in point, UAE. Their foreign minister, their ambassador to the U.S. was on this week with George Stephanopoulos, had Jonathan Carl on. And this is what she said about why Iran has targeted them over 2,600 times, even more than they have targeted Israel. Cut eight.
For us, it's very clear that they've chosen to go down this path because we are everything that they're not. We're a model of economic prosperity. We have 200 nationalities that live there. We have religions and cultures from all around the world. We used our oil wealth to build an economic powerhouse. They used their wealth for nuclear programs that are nefarious, for missiles, drones, proxies, etc. So whereas we tried to become and have become an international global responsible player, they are a pariah state. And they wanted to break that model, but they underestimated our resolve.
So can you believe this? Instead of saying, okay, U.S., get out, get off our bases, they said finish the job. And that attitude is something I thought I'd never hear from a Middle East official.
No, Brian, you're right. I mean, this is a remarkable moment. That statement alone flies in the face of kind of all the propaganda that Israel is the problem, the United States is the problem. Here you have leading Arab countries saying, no, 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 Iran is the problem. And many of us, of course, have known this for a long time. But to have the Arab states now say so publicly, I think undercuts the Iranian regime in ways that only their neighbors could do.
And I want to talk about Mondami and what he just said yesterday, Michael Goodwin. But I also want to just finish it up with this. The UAE has a request. They've basically requested an economic lifeline. They since their oil and gas has been, infrastructure has been severely damaged, they essentially want their central bank discussed a possible currency swap with the U.S. Treasury here. A swap line would give the UAE access to U.S. dollars to stabilize its currency, and we have to do it. They said if they have to, they'll turn to China, but they don't want to. They want to stay with us. If we could do it for Argentina, we should do it for them, don't you think?
Oh, yes. I think we have to help however we can within, of course, common sense. Look, I think they have been loyal throughout this. I wish, frankly, Brian, that the Arab states had taken a more active role in the war, given how much punishment they received from Iran for not helping Iran. But I do think that this has been a moment from which there is no going backwards. The Middle East, that model that Iran had terrified everybody else, that's over now. Iran is not completely yet, but this is a moment of change. This is a very big change that is unfolding before us.
So I want you to hear, as we move over to the mayor yesterday, for some reason he's a big celebrity and a big get. And that's what Meet the Press interviewed him again. Here he is, cut 13.
Now that you've bumped up against the hard realities of a $5.4 billion budget shortfall and the other red tape that you have to go through, do you still believe in democratic socialism? Do you still think it can be effective?
I believe in it even more than I did the day before. And that's because of the fact that it is focused on the needs of working people. And working people need that focus, that fight from politicians more than ever.
Really? Do you think he believes that?
Well, he may believe it, but I thought, frankly, it was the wrong question. It's about the reality of how much bigger can government get? You have this huge deficit. You want to keep raising taxes, but that's already driving people out of the city and the state. I think that's the question. Is there no limit to your spending dreams and your taxation ideas? I mean, I think that's what's at stake here.
I hear you. And lastly, a little bit more from him as he talked about taxing the rich. Standing in front of Ken Griffin, this is the CEO of Citadel Apartment, and saying he's going to get taxed more because it's his second home and it's worth more than $5 million. Listen to this and what he plans on doing in the future. Cut 17.
When I ran for mayor, I said I was going to tax the rich. Well, today, we're taxing the rich. I'm thrilled to announce we've secured a pied-à-terre tax, the first in New York's history. This is an annual fee on luxury properties worth more than $5 million, whose owners do not live full-time in the city. Like for this penthouse, which hedge fund CEO Ken Griffin bought for $238 million. This pied-à-terre tax is specifically designed for the richest of the rich, those who store their wealth in New York City real estate, but who don't actually live here. But even so, they're able to reap the huge financial rewards of owning property in, dare I say, the greatest city in the world. And most of the time, these units are sitting empty, since again, they don't actually live here. This is a fundamentally unfair system that hurts working New Yorkers. Now, it's coming to an end.
What's wrong with him? Because he lived there. Sometimes he lives here. Sometimes he doesn't. It's a second home. Do you realize they can't even fill up all the apartments and condos in that building? They're talking about the plaza, which they converted to residential dwellings. And he looks at Ken Griffin as the bad guy. If I'm the mayor, I want more of those people living here.
Absolutely. And you know, Brian, he acts as though they don't pay taxes. They actually do pay real estate taxes on those condos. So this idea that they're not contributing to New York, they spend a lot of money here. They make possible jobs for construction workers and retail, and all kinds of jobs are dependent on wealthy people buying homes, whether it's second or third or fourth. It doesn't matter. And yet, it's a level of ignorance about Mamdani and his ideas of what the economy moves on. He just doesn't understand. And unfortunately, the governor is helping him spread this ignorance around the city and state.
Yeah, she's trying to do the same thing. She wants people to tax people's second homes. When you realize that they'll go to Tennessee, they're going to go to Florida, they're going to go to Texas, where they're welcomed. They're not going to go to California. They're not going to go to New York. They're not going to go to Massachusetts. It's just a fact. So I can't believe they don't see it. And my last point is, Michael, are you shocked that with all the next generation Democrats coming up, whether it's Beshear, Shapiro, Newsom, maybe it's Rahm Emanuel, Barack Obama decides to sing Wheels on the Bus with Mondami. Listen to this. Cut 15. He has said, I'll mentor you. This is a raging socialist. He thinks that's the future of the party. Does that shock you?
Well, I agree with him, unfortunately. I think it is the future of the Democratic Party. And in all kinds of ways, they've taken such a sharp left turn. And I think you can argue, Brian, that it started under Obama. I mean, certainly as you look back to Bill Clinton or other Democratic presidents, Obama was the most leftist at all, introduced the most leftist legislation. Biden, of course, followed along. But essentially, I think Obama really is a godfather of the Mondani type of Democratic candidates.
I wish you were wrong, and I fear you're right, because Rahm Emanuel, I'm not going to vote for Rahm Emanuel, but I would say the fact that he said education has been a problem. Democrats have dropped the ball. Forget about gender politics. Women don't belong in men don't belong in women's sports. He started just talking practically. And with the relationship they've had from Chicago, I thought, okay, the president's going to go, it doesn't matter what I think. What can win? I mean, Mondami can't win a national election, I hope. AOC can't win a national election, I hope. And why would a former president, the most popular Democrat, put his money with a inexperienced, certain-to-fail 34-year-old? Just final thought.
Yeah, I think Obama sees in Mamdani kind of like a political son for him, someone that he will work with and help however he can. But I think Mamdani, for better and worse, is now the face of the new Democratic Party. Much as AOC was, I think Mamdani has trumped her. So I think the party is going further and further left with every election. And I think Obama has decided, I'm going to get on that train.
Yep, the Bernie Sanders train. Graham Plantier, the Maine Senate candidate, Abdul El Said, the Michigan Senate candidate, and Anaya Mejia, the New Jersey congresswoman who replaced Mikey Mikey Sherrill, who became the new governor of New Jersey. Thanks so much, Michael Goodwin.
My pleasure.
All right. 1-866-408-7669. I'll take your calls next. Brian Kilmeade.
politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
We've got a bit of a situation, Brian. I think it's becoming a circus at the top between, you know, Steyer and Katie Porter. And I just couldn't imagine turning over the reins of California in the situation that it is, which is in a crisis of housing and growth and spending, to a guy like Tom or to Katie. Let's elect people, whether you're on the right or you're on the left, whether you're a Democrat, Republican, or you're an independent, who are well qualified and actually have the experience of getting the right results.
Rick Caruso, who is a very successful billionaire, who was on with me on Sunday on One Nation, coming on talking about the fact that Democrats can't run this state and they need somebody somewhat moderate. He thinks it's Matt Mahan. I think it could be Steve Hilton. I don't know much about this sheriff, but there's nothing that Gavin Newsom's doing to make anything better. Katie Porter's a nightmare of a human being. She has not shown that she could run anything. Now, obviously, you guys thought Eric Swalwell was going to be the guy. He was leading in the polls. And now you have Xavier Becerra. It was a terrible HHS director, who's a ridiculous congressman, a blatant partisan who wants the title, doesn't want to do the job. So my thing is, you got to find somebody that can perform. I like to, what that mayor's doing in San Francisco is quite encouraging. Steve Hilton's leading in most of the polls, or second. Going against Matt Mahan, just somebody reasonable in the middle, because most of these blue states are in crisis. And by the way, Illinois is not any better. But this guy is just putting billions of dollars in Pritzker to make you think it's better.
Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
The guy who has been in construction, hospitality, agricultural, healthcare, and manufacturing, long-term, who does not have a criminal record, why don't we give him the dignity status? That's it. No federal programs. He has to pay $7,000 in fines. He has to pay 1% of his salary over 7 years. No federal programs. And the only thing he's going to do is not get deported. Will never be American. Do you think Hispanics want to be Americans? Some of them may. I know that community better than anybody. So what I'm saying is, why don't we embrace them? We do not give them path to citizenship, but we let them stay and work in those five sectors that will help the average American guy, not the big business.
And we know Michael Lawler, another Republican, is for that. And that is Congresswoman Maria Elvira Salazar of Florida, pushing the Dignity Act. But number one, bad word. That's something that makes you think of Joe Biden. But it's saying the people that are here prior to Joe Biden taking office, they have a extended, essentially, a work visa. They don't have to be deported. But they're never become citizens. How do you feel about that? Let's ask Congressman Brandon Gill of the 26th District over in Texas. Welcome back, Congressman. Great to see you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
How do you feel about the Dignity Act?
I think the Dignity Act, put bluntly, is the biggest spit in the face to all of the voters who elected us last election cycle to deport illegal aliens. That was the primary issue of the 2024 elections, was the American people screaming and saying, we've had enough of mass migration. We've had enough of people pouring across our border illegally. We want our country back. And Republicans were elected to secure the border and to get illegal aliens out of our community. So to turn around whenever voters ask for mass deportations and say, you know what, instead we're going to give you amnesty, I think is an absolutely unforgivable betrayal.
Well, how do you feel about what's happening in different states with Minneapolis and others, where a lot of people said, yeah, I'm for stopping illegal immigration, but I'm not for that?
Well, I think that most Americans want the border secure. The vast majority of Americans want the border secure.
And it's done.
But most Americans also, and that's done, but most Americans also want to be able to live in an America that is American. They want to be able to go to jobs and get good paying wages that are not being suppressed by mass migration, by the very people that the Dignity Act would bring into the country or allow to stay into the country. They want to ensure that their schools are not flooded with deadly drugs that have been pouring across the country from the very people that this bill, in many cases, would give amnesty to. The American people are absolutely, adamantly vehemently against amnesty. We've gone over this before.
Do you think amnesty, if you don't get a citizen, if you stay, do you think that's amnesty? You're not going to be a citizen.
Of course it is. Let me put it this way. Right now, there's about 12 million illegal aliens who are in the country who came in prior to the Biden administration. Right now, those illegal aliens are subject to deportation under the terms of the Dignidad Act. And remember, this is a bill written in a foreign language. Under the terms of the Dignidad Act, those illegal aliens would no longer be subject to deportation. They would be allowed to stay in the United States. That is the definition of amnesty.
What would you say to the farmers and meat packers who probably voted for you, who say, listen, I need these people?
Yeah, I would say that our job is to represent the interests of our voters. And that's not just the farmers and the meat packers. That's also the people who are working at these places. That's the American worker who is seeing wages being suppressed isn't being able to get jobs because we're bringing in millions of unvetted, unskilled foreign workers who are taking their jobs. Those are the people I think the Republican Party needs to be looking out for as well. And listen, if we want to say that we are the party of the working class, and I believe that we are, and I believe that we should be, we cannot do amnesty. You cannot say that you're the party of the working class and then turn around and flood the country with cheap labor. Those two things are incompatible. You got to pick one.
So so when those farmers come up, I'm sure you've had farmers in Texas tell you that they have a different view on that, right?
Oh, I've heard that occasionally. I think most farmers in Texas recognize, though, that mass migration does undermine this country. That, you know, whenever you bring in a large population of foreigners who are working in unskilled jobs, not only does it suppress wages and impact the labor market in a way that harms working class Americans, but by the way, we are paying for that. The Federation for American Immigration Reform estimates that illegal immigration costs the American taxpayer about $150 billion every single year. And that is net of tax receipts. That's net of the tax that they're paying into the system. And that's because not only do these illegal aliens often get on welfare, but their children and their families are on welfare through a variety of programs. And those programs would still exist under the Dignidad Act. So on net, this is a huge problem. And again, this is something we ran on last cycle. Republicans did not, we didn't beat around the bush at all. We held up signs at the RNC last cycle that said mass deportations. There's nothing subtle about that. You cannot run on a platform of mass deportations and then turn around and do the exact opposite of that and expect to have a viable Republican Party. You know, we're always told, and we've been told this for decades now, Republicans need to embrace amnesty if you're going to be the big tent party. The reality is amnesty would burn the tent to the ground. And that's what I'm trying to stop here.
So what about extended work visas with the 7 million open jobs that you have right now in the country?
Well, I'd like to see the labor market adjust so that wages can rise for working class Americans who have seen stagnant wages for so long. I think, again, those are the people that we need to be looking out for. Those are the people who, by the way, elected President Trump in 2016, that elected him this past cycle. Those are the core Republican voter base now as well. So I don't think that we need to be increasing work visas to bring people into the country to take American jobs.
But do you think your support in the Hispanic community is as low as the numbers say? They say it's now in the 30s and you guys were approaching the 50s.
Well, I'm skeptical of some of this, and I'll tell you that we're constantly told you got to change Republican or conservative policy on a fundamental conservative level in order to pander to the Hispanic community. That's kind of the message that sort of the establishment has been pushing for a long time. Well, you know what? President Trump did the exact opposite of that. He treated Hispanics the same way he treats everybody else in this country, which I think is what we should do. President Trump was the first person who went back in 2016, said we need to be building a wall. And you know what? A lot of people on both sides of the aisle called him racist, said Hispanics are never going to move to the Republican Party if that's what Republicans are saying. And they started shifting. And you know what? Last cycle, whenever we ran on a clear platform of mass deportations, Hispanics moved into the Republican Party in record numbers. So listen, I believe that that is what the Hispanic American community recognizes that as well. Their wages are being suppressed, too.
So the TPS with Haiti, there's 350,000 Haitians here temporarily. So why could it? So that's temporary by the definition. So the president wants to lift it send them back. Yep. And now a judge can just stop that. So we have to wait for this to work its way up.
Yeah, it's another example of judges stepping in and trying to take executive prerogative. Remember, temporary protective status, as you said, was meant originally to be temporary. It was originally designated back in 2010, and it was redesignated, re-upped again and again and again, to the point where now 69% of patients covered under temporary protective status didn't come in during 2010 whenever the earthquake happened. They came in during the Biden administration as just illegal aliens, just like all the other illegals who were coming in during that time. That's the problem here. This is morphed into a de facto amnesty plan. And we had a vote just last week on it. I think Congress should have rejected it. Unfortunately, they didn't. This was a Democrat dream to extend this.
Just on the immigration overall, but Reagan made a big mistake. He actually said, if you're here, you're going to have amnesty. But he depended on Congress. Democrats were in charge to secure the border. And they didn't.
Yep.
But what you guys just did is secure the border. No one thought that was possible, let alone in under a year, in under 6 months. So now they're building a wall, I think 5 miles a week or 10 miles a week, building a wall. So this will be secure. Do you believe that the reason why the Senate race is so close in Texas and that you seem to be losing some ground in some of the tough races have anything to do with the aggressive way you're pursuing illegal immigrants in the country?
No, I don't think by and large that that's the issue. You know, the midterm elections, whenever one party has the presidency and the House and the Senate, are typically very tough. In fact, we would be bucking the historical trend for the House of Representatives, for Republicans to maintain a majority in the House of Representatives. That's just how elections typically operate. There's always ways to improve in immigration enforcement, of course, but I don't think that that's the driving factor here. I think that you've got a much bigger macro political picture.
If you do immigration reform, like fix all the stuff that's not even controversial. There's just, for example, you marry a woman from another country. Everything's on the up and up. The amount of time and the cost, it makes it cost prohibitive for a lot of people just trying to make it in this country, doing things the right way. But if you get together on immigration reform, what areas would you think you'd have to give in order to codify what Trump has done? A lot of people worry for the next president, especially if it's a Democrat, they're not going to fortify the border and crack down like this president is. How do you put something on the books that makes that part of the law?
Yeah, well, I'm always open to having a conversation about what we can do in order to codify the president's border policies. But I'm not going to have that conversation if amnesty is the demand. I think amnesty is off the table right now. That is not something that we ran on. That would be an unforgivable betrayal of the voters who sent us here. So we can have conversations about other parts of immigration, whether it's visas or something like that, things that I don't think that we ought to expand in any way. If that's part of the legislative process, but I'm not going to start from the framework of amnesty.
So, Congressman, what's going to happen with the FISA law? You know, the president, as much as he's been burned by it, he wants to extend it, and now it's in a 2-week hold, or I guess it's going to be extended 2 weeks while you debate it. What would you like to see happen?
Yeah, well, FISA is one of those issues. The president, more than just about anybody else, has been burned by FISA. And he's talked about wanting to reform this program. I mean, FISA was the program used to spy on his campaign back in 2016. But since then, you know, the president is in office right now. We've got a conflict in Iran going on. You've got the president focused on immigration policy and deportations, and he's asked for a clean short-term extension of FISA authority. And if that's what the president's asking for, I'm going to be there with him.
So why do you think some in your party are not?
You know, I think that there's some who are but want to see more reforms put into place. FISA was reformed, I believe it was about 2 years ago. It was before I was in the House. And there were 56 reforms put into place to help reduce or eliminate the abuses that the authority that had been utilized under FISA authority. And I think that some people would like to see more reforms. A lot of those reforms are good ideas. But right now, the president's asking again for a short-term extension. And like you said, I'm going to be with the president on that.
All right. And where do you stand on the Senate race? Who are you endorsing? Cornyn or Paxton?
I endorsed Ken Paxton in that race. You know, and a lot of that has to do with immigration and the fact that I think that Texans want a fighter in that Senate race who's going to represent their values boldly in Washington, who's going to fight against amnesty and is going to fight against and is going to stand up for us. And Ken Paxton's going to do that.
All right. It's going to be a big battle. We'll find out in May. Yep. A lot of resources. And then it's going to be off to the general, which is anything but a layup. Congressman Brandon Gill, thanks so much.
Yep. Thanks for having me.
You got it. 1-866-408-7669. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't move.
From breaking news to big name guests, Brian brings you insight you won't hear anywhere else. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Our bet was you open this up, you let Americans travel down there, you let Americans invest there. This place is 90 miles from Paris. Cubans' lives are the better, and then ultimately, we're not going to be the ones to determine it. We're not going to be the ones to pick the next leader of Cuba, but we think that will work better than what we've been doing for 6 years. Trump came in. He, over time, with the urging of Marco Rubio in the first term, basically rolled back all of the opening in terms of like travel and investment and things like that. They kept the embassies open, so the diplomatic relations piece remained. And then over time, they squeezed and squeezed and squeezed. Biden was a chicken and was afraid to go back to the Obama policy because he was afraid of Bob Menendez. So we somehow got the Trump policy through Joe Biden's administration. In the same way that Biden was afraid to come back into the JCPOA because he was afraid of Bob Menendez and FDD for criticizing him. But the point is that now Cubans are suffering more than they ever have, I think, in their history. They have, because in addition to the sanctions, there's now a fuel blockade on Cuba from the Trump administration. You have people dying because of those sanctions. I think Americans don't like to think about that. But the reality is when the power goes off, babies in the NICU and people on ventilators die in hospitals. You've got extreme malnourishment in Cuba. So it's a real dire humanitarian circumstance in Cuba right now.
But that is all on the leaders. That's Ben Rhodes of the National Security Advisor to and Foreign Policy Advisor to President Obama. So he was saying that, Cuba's dying on the vine. He calls out Joe Biden. It's true. They did nothing. Instead, they propped him up and they stay in between. So what the president is in between dialogue with the current and having some type of soft landing with the current team, we led by Miguel Diaz-Canel. Or you go in there with some hard power and say, listen, you're done. Now, they have a few, they have like 25,000 soldiers or something to that nature, and all the money is with the military. I get it. And the military has their own investments. But we let one tanker go through of oil and gas. That's just about out. That was Russia about 2 weeks ago. But right now, the president's got his hands full with Iran. But believe me, there are operations underway identifying potential new leaders. And there's one Castro in particular they're interested in, not the playboy or likes to party, but there's another guy who is Fidel's great grandson who they seem to be talking to. But if I bring up that to anybody in Cuba, in America of Cuban descent, they say no one named Castro can continue to rule that country. But it's about to fall on its own weight. That's what's happening. So that is great news. And the one thing they left out is where the reason why it's falling is not because of any blockade. It's not because of sanctions. It's not because of recognition or embassy openings. It's Venezuela. Venezuela was keeping it open. Cuba was providing Maduro's security. Cuba was also through Bolivia and through a lot of these other Central American countries with their communist backing, a lot of China and Russia money, and their training. They have pretty good training. They actually have very good medical care. So they're using a lot of Cuban doctors. That's all drying up. That's all done. Quick announcement. Coming up on my tour dates, Uniting the States is my book that you could pre-order now at anywhere you prefer. It's a book I think you're really going to love, especially on America 250. So I just got to announce we're going to be with streaming on Fox Nation. We're now in Reno, Nevada, May 30th. History, Liberty, and Laughs at the Hawkins Amphitheater. Then July 11th in Pensacola, Florida at the Sanger Theater. Red Bank, New Jersey, October 16th. The book will be out the week before. Then we'll be followed the next day in Westbury, Long Island. And then in November, that's on the 17th. November 7th in Clearwater, Florida. And then November 8th in beautiful Jacksonville at the Florida Theater. That's a beautiful place. And then in St. Louis in Chesterfield, Missouri at the Factory. BrianKilmeade.com for tickets.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show coming your way. 1-866-408-7669. This hour, we're going to be joined by Shelley Moore Capito. At the bottom of the hour, I'll be able to take some of your calls. Not in this block, but the next block for sure. So line up in order. We also have some emails to get to, too. Some of you wrote me over the weekend about One Nation, which is every Sunday at 10 p.m. We have also, just a reminder, we got this great YouTube channel started up a few months ago. YouTube.com/@TheBrianKilmeadeShow. So you'll get to packages here. You'll get the some interviews of this show, some highlights if you ever miss it, but also other things that are going on the channel. It's a complete channel. I think you'll love it. So subscribe to it. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
100% of Virginians want election results to be respected. We're deeply worried that Donald Trump will try to interfere with the election results this November or in 2028 because we saw him do it before.
You're just such a clown. Senator Tim Kaine trying to rationalize the gerrymandering that's going on in Virginia. Look, if you want to say because they did it in Texas, we're doing it in Virginia, own it. Don't say because Donald Trump is trying to steal an election.
Number two.
I'm actually happy to tell you that that pied-à-terre tax, that is an agreement that we have to tax the wealthy. I always said that I believed in the importance of taxing the rich. This is taxing the rich.
Top 25% are paying 80% of all the taxes in the entire country. And Zohran Mamdani thinks the problem is not enough money in the system. The proud socialist, despite the rockiest of starts and a $5.4 billion budget deficit, the socialist mayor of New York is not backing off or modifying his socialistic ways. He is in the middle of an epic fail, and sadly, we're all going to feel it here.
Number one.
Anybody who has dealt with the Iranians will tell you it is often two steps forward, three steps back. They're incredibly slippery. They can't be trusted.
That is Ambassador Michael Waltz. Back to war. That's what I fear. Iran's hardliners have taken over the talks as VP Vance is going to be heading to Pakistan with no clear agenda, or it's not even clear if talks are going to take place. But here's what's impactful. It's not, well, the talk's going to take place and negotiations are going to happen. The ceasefire ends on Tuesday. So you're not happy that over the weekend or Sunday, we boarded a ship and took it over. What was that ship? That ship was full of material from China. And that ship has was taken over in the Strait of Hormuz. We told 20 ships to turn around, and they have. This one did not. It's called the Tuska, and it's owned by an Iranian company that the United States is accused of procuring material for Tehran's ballistic missile program. It was in part of the Republic of Iran's shipping lanes, the state-owned company under U.S., British, and European Union sanctions that has been described by the U.S. State Department as, quote, the preferred shipping line for the Iranian profiteers and procurement agents. So the Tuska will carry up to 4,800 20-foot-long containers, has been traveling back from China at a chemical storage port laden with cargo. So China is feeling it. We are stopping it. And Iran says, okay, we're going to just seal off the Strait of Hormuz. We go, we'll blockade the whole thing. So nothing's getting in and out. And guess who's not benefiting? Guess who's not benefiting? China. And guess who's hurting? Iran. They think time's on their side because there's political pressure here. They don't understand our system. There's political pressure on everything. There's political pressure on FISA, political pressure on ICE. There's political pressure on to pass the Voting Rights Act. That's just what we do. And we do it publicly. And they think that by pressuring us, that the president's going to break. When are they going to realize the president's for real? But what also is for real is the Institute of Study of War, repeated and written up today by the New York Post, says that they've changed leadership. No longer is the foreign minister, Arachi, who was seeking to secure a grand bargain, in charge. The IRGC has now taken over the talks. And it's this guy named Vahadi and Zoldar's alliance that goes beyond the military blockade with the IRGC commanders. So the IRGC, instead of just being in the room with the politicians, is now running things. And the IRGC and the Iranian new supreme leader, should he still be alive, and I assume he is, Mojtabi Khomeini, who ascended to replace his father, who is basically underground, afraid to communicate electronically, thinks he's going to be killed, already lost a leg and is disfigured. Well, he's the one who put in power the IRGC. So what are we dealing with here? Do they really want to be finished off and have more severe damage? Do they want more of an opportunity to hit our Gulf state allies and further alienate them? Perhaps they do. For them, they have to be looking around saying, we're the recipient of 15,000 separate strikes. Here's General David Petraeus. Cut one.
Iran needs to give up its interference with the freedom of navigation through the Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz, give up the effort to try to turn that into a Panama Canal in which they can charge tolls of $2 million per ship. And also, I think we need to be a bit cautious about what Lebanon can do with Hezbollah. Absolutely the right policies to encourage them, to help their military strengthen, to be able to take on Hezbollah more and more. But I think that's the one where there are some limitations on what realistically can be achieved.
I agree. In fact, Reem Al-Assami, who is the foreign minister from the United Arab Emirates, the ambassador to the U.S., I should say, she weighed in. And she knows the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Kuwait are going to be targeted should this war resume on Tuesday. Cut 10.
Look, trust is earned. Right. And what we've seen so far has been a pure demonstration of a lot of hostility. So the onus is really on them to demonstrate that they are not going to be going forward in the way that the trajectory has been so far. But trust is earned, John. And we are not fools. We've seen them even before February 28th, when this started, a couple of weeks before that, one of our senior ministers was in Tehran talking through how are we going to be able to deal with, as I said, the realities of geography. Right now, they're going to have to really step up in a significant way for us to be able to believe what they say again.
So you see that on February 28th, they're talking. And then the foreign minister said after the first 2 days of strikes, people were shocked that Gulf states are getting hit. And the foreign minister came out and says, you know, we're aiming for the American bases, not aiming for you, and you guys are our allies. The next, I think, within two hours, the IRGC was shelling UAE again, and then there's over 2,800 strikes through missiles and drones, more than Israel. Why is that? I think people are realizing, and what I've said before, I'm not telling you the UAE, Bahrain, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Oman, and Qatar to a degree are ever going to be the democracies that we feel comfortable in. They're going to be tolerant of all religions the way we are today. Got it. Understood. But the gains they've made are so front and center now that we see the difference between them and Iran. And you know who understands it? The Iranians. Now, when 9/11 families listened to Saudi Arabian reapproachment in terms of an alliance or a relationship, economic and diplomatic, they get worried. They say, wow, man, they were part of 9/11. What did the royal family know? Well, it wasn't part of leadership, but there were probably members of the royal family who sympathized with bin Laden. But that was 25 years ago. And when we wanted to see change in the Middle East, we don't want to kill everybody. We don't want to fight every single country in the Middle East. We would hope the change would take place. It's easy to get caught up in this fight with Iran and say, man, the Middle East is just one mess after another, and not see the progress has been made. Huge progress to the point where it can point on one hand, three fingers, the problem. Hezbollah, Hamas, supplied by Iran. That's really it. Of course, Qatar, I got problems with. They play both sides of the aisle. I get it. But man, wouldn't it be great if Iran wasn't on the other side and we weren't on the other? And it used to be, you know, there was a problem with Sunnis and Shia in America. Now there's only a problem with Shia extremists and the ISIS, who are Sunni, and Al-Qaeda that exist. But we're all over it, punishing them wherever we can, especially if they spread through Africa. Before we take a break, I do want to talk about Zohran Mamdani, who people are celebrating. You know, he's got 48% approval rating. You know, Eric Adams had 62% at this point. Even de Blasio had better ratings. He was the worst mayor in my lifetime. But Mamdani is happy with where things are right now. Even though there's a story today out that we have $100 million being wasted in free preschool. We have 24 empty buildings. De Blasio put it forward. Eric Adams put it forward. And now we have $100 million being wasted on empty buildings on free preschools. The exact cost is $99.3 million. And guess what? No one's tackled it. No one's tried to either disband it, fill it up with kids, or not fill it up, fund it, find teachers. They just let it rot. You want more money, but you're letting all this, and I'm not saying it's fraud. It's more incompetence, more wasted money on the books. Here's Zoran Mamdani being asked about socialism. Cut 13. So that is Barack Obama. That's not the cut we wanted, but that's Barack Obama singing Wheels on the Bus with the mayor. It blows me away that the former president of the United States would look at all these politicians, potential 2028 candidates, Westmore, Bashir, Shapiro, Newsom, Pritzker. He is all over mentoring this 34-year-old socialist who, on paper, has no shot at a higher office as long as he believes this communist socialist doctrine. Listen to him talk about it. Cut 13.
Now that you've bumped up against the hard realities of a $5.4 billion budget shortfall and the other red tape that you have to go through, do you still believe in democratic socialism? Do you still think it can be effective?
I believe in it even more than I did the day before. And that's because of the fact that it is focused on the needs of working people, and working people need that focus, that fight from politicians more than ever.
Obviously, he says nothing. I mean, you should have pressed up. Well, how are you supposed to make this up? Why do you think taxing the rich is going to attract more rich? Why do you want people to pay 87% of all the taxes to pay more? Why is that the issue? Maybe you should be looking at cutting spending. But instead, he talks about just raising taxes. Same thing's happening in Maine. You have a guy that's Graham Plantner, who, again, supported and mentored by Bernie Sanders, a socialist who should be marginalized, not even a Democrat. This guy is beating the sitting governor, who is not a worthy candidate, way too old and way too ineffective. But this guy with a Nazi tattoo says more crazy things than you can imagine. Listen to him talk. Cut 16.
We all want to get rid of Susan Collins. We all want to turn Maine blue. But it very much matters what kind of Democrats we turn the Senate blue with. We are in a mortal crisis of our democracy now. Nobody wants to live in interesting times, but we do. We need to rise to the occasion. We need to understand that we have a place in the American story. And that here, in Maine, in 2026, in this Senate race, we have an opportunity to change not just the future of Maine, but the future of American politics.
Right. Obviously, he said nothing, but he stands for socialism, and his radical, I have PTSD from my days as a Marine, is not flying with all the extreme beliefs that he has. But it seems to be resonating, at least with the Democrats that remain in Maine. I just don't know why, in the big picture, why Democrats don't say, why do we have the socialists? You know, why do I have to take the socialists? Why can't Democrats have some criteria? Let them form their own party. Unless you feel that Democrats are socialists, if there were Republican socialists, I'm telling you, they would not be accepted into the party. Forget the big tent. No, because what you do is you don't fundamentally stand for the American competitiveness and capitalism. You can't be fundamentally in the same place. Same with Islamists. Why do they feel so comfortable in the Democratic Party? On the paper, what do they have to do with the Democratic Party? Who are you for, you know, health care for all, and, you know, for, I guess, raising taxes? But these guys are just against the American system, and they seem to have a place there in order to win a seat. But once they get there, they're going to be, you know, the squad can be isolated because there's so few of them. But man, when you get more and more senators and congressmen and women in there, you will change the party and you will change the country. That's scary. All right. When we come back, we'll take your calls. And then at the bottom of the hour, Senator Capito of West Virginia, you're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Where big stories meet bigger conversations. Stay informed and energized with the Brian Kilmeade Show.
show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
For our conversations with the White House and the president, the FBI is going to be spearheading the effort collectively with our partners at the Department of Energy and the Department of War. These missing and killed scientists and former professional members of the Department of Energy vary in wide range. And we're working most importantly with our state and local partners who have the jurisdiction on each of these cases, whether they be a homicide or a missing persons case, they have the evidence. So what we're going to do is collectively pull it all into one place. We started this process last week, and then we're going to look for connections, like you said, on whether there are connections to classified access to classified information and or foreign actors. And then we will produce that information to the White House and the world because it's of such great public importance. And if there's any connections that lead to nefarious conduct or conspiracy, this FBI will make the appropriate arrest.
And that is Kash Patel yesterday talking about the missing 11 American scientists who have something to do with the nuclear program, something to do with the space program, something to do with defense-related research. I mean, some of these people, 58 years old, the prime of their life, just disappear. Some died, maybe some legitimate, but I was listening to a few experts and investigators, and they say that it's impossible to, for all these to be a coincidence. And I got to worry that if I'm involved in that program, that I might be next. Also, some of the exchanges with some of these scientists said if someone comes up to you and says that I killed myself, or it turns out that I'm dead, or I killed somebody else, just know it's not true. I mean, I've never said that to anyone in my life. Have you? But some of these scientists have had these conversations with people in their family. Somehow they've picked up that they're being watched or they're being hacked, and that we're afraid it's going to lead to something else. So this is pretty serious stuff. And I think that we got to, for national security reasons, let alone trying to protect people, we have to look into that. The Energy Secretary, Chris Wright, also asked about this. Cut 38.
There's a coordinated investigation across various branches of the government. But yeah, a lot of the nuclear security, nuclear scientists are in DOE. So yes, of course we are looking into this. Too early to say about that. We haven't found anything alarming yet.
All right, Chris Wright weighs in. So I asked you guys to email me, and you've been emailing me also about the show and last night's show too. Charles writes and says some nice things, and then says, my thought is about a warrant. Finding a warrant to arrest an illegal alien. We talked about this. My thought is the citations can be issued to make the arrest. If you or I get stopped for DUI, we would receive a citation, almost likely be brought into custody. We would then go before a judge with a citation. We would not tell the arresting officer that he has to have a warrant. Thereby, why can't illegals be brought before an immigration judge without a simple citation? I agree with you. How about this email from David? David says, please stop pronouncing Nevada wrong. Don't say Nevada. You have to say Nevada, because we're going to be in Reno on May 30th. Every time I say it, I say Reno, Nevada. They say it's supposed to be Nevada. Did you know that?
I didn't, but we better make sure we get it right.
It doesn't seem right. And finally, Ken writes about NATO. He thinks they're useless. When the Soviets dismantled the Soviet Union in 83, NATO should have been dismantled too. Ken, I like the alliance. I like our role in it. I just want to make sure people pull their own weight. And I think they will when this is said and done.
He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, we are back, 1-866-408-7669. A lot going on. We're trying to see if it's going to be worth it for the vice president to fly all the way to Pakistan. We're also seeing that it looks like right now, without the ceasefire, the ceasefire is closest to expiring than being extended. We have not heard much from the White House since we took over that ship, the Iranian ship that didn't listen. So we stopped it. We blew out their engine room, and then we boarded the ship. At the same time, the Iranians have said there'll be retaliation for that. Good luck with that. The IRGC looks to have taken over the negotiations. We don't know for sure. No one's really on the inside, but we'll find out if anybody shows up. If no one shows up, the IRGC says they want to continue the fight. Certainly politically and economically, it'd be more challenging. But is it inevitable to finish the job the right way? Oil is now up $4.62. Not much. Still under $90. And the market really has not gone down too much. It's still over 49,370. It's down 76 points. I think people are learning, don't overreact to the rhetoric on both sides. Let's bring in Senator Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia. Senator, your thoughts about where we're at right now with Iran?
Well, I think we're at a very critical point. I certainly hope the Iranians come back to the table. We're sending over our vice president and others to negotiate here. And I think the proven, I think, theory this week is how pivotal the Straits of Hormuz is, but how we can take it over and blockade it, which will really hurt the Iranians financially. And I think that realization has hit them, so they're trying to sort of bully their way through it. I read an article this morning that was hinting at a lot of internal disagreements within the Iranian power structure to decide what direction to go. But I do think this is a pivotal moment, and I hope the ceasefire continues.
Oh, well, I'll tell you what, the foreign minister says he wanted a comprehensive agreement, a big deal, like a super deal. And now it looks like the IRG says, no, that's not going to happen. And they might be putting one of their commanders into the room if they, in fact, show up. But if they don't show up, how could you extend the ceasefire? They're saying we don't care. Yet they right. don't fully understand how much more damage we can do. The problem is the oil and gas is going to suffer, and the Gulf states are going to be targeted again, and probably Israel. But it could be the last gasp of an ugly regime that needs to die.
Yeah, and I think maybe what we're seeing are the signals that the internal conflict that they're having as a country, I think, shows the weakening of their power structure. That's good, but they still are better off talking. I actually saw where the president offered to speak with them himself to try to get this de-escalated and to a final conclusion. So I think the will is there for the president and the vice president and those of us who are watching this situation very closely. And so we'll see what happens. But I think they'd be making a big mistake to not show up.
So,
and they'd be thumbing their nose at us. We can't go into it if they're just not going to be there.
I know. After 15,000 strikes on vital areas of their economy, their missile program, their manufacturing program, everything that we've done, blowing up most of their nuclear sites, but still leave one, the pickaxe site, still untouched because it's so deep into the mountain.
Right.
But for the most part, the damage they've taken, they still want to take more. Good luck with that. We'll see what happens because we've had 10 days to reload. So I want to bring you to something else. First off, the feeling amongst Republicans, I understand, in the Senate in particular, it went from how many seats will you gain in the Senate to can you hold the Senate? And there's a feeling among leadership and that perhaps there's pressure on the president to end this quickly so affordability can be the focus again. Do you feel as though the White House feels the pressure that you're feeling?
Well, I do think that anytime a president comes in, his own party has difficulties in the next elections. I mean, that's historic. I think we will hold the Senate, and I think we're going to surprise everybody. We have great candidates. We've got lots to talk about. But the affordability issue with the higher prices of gasoline is definitely a critical issue for our voters. And if you go further to be able to de-escalate the situation in Iran would obviously help with that, with having the oil flowing. And that's where we're hoping we're going to go. But we've got 11% more people getting refunds. We've got higher wages. We've got more people back to work. So there's a lot of good news here. We just can't get the chance to really get it out to show that we've been looking out for people's pocketbooks.
In a way, it reminds me of the Russia investigation. You're doing all these things economically, sealing the border, but everybody wanted to talk about Russia all the time. Now, this is different.
Right.
This is Iran. We're dealing with an enemy we've had for a while. But no matter what happens, like, for example, making those tax cuts permanent are a huge story. You know, the growth in the banking industry and other things are a huge story. Sealing the border is a huge story. So a manufacturing increase is a huge story. But I'm going to bring you to something a little disturbing, if I find disturbing. The Washington Post did a survey about where the American public is with the Palestinian-Israeli situation. 50-50. Just as many people are sympathetic towards the Palestinians than the Israelis. For the Republicans, the GOP, 81% says Israel is in the right. For the Dems, only 25% of Democrats side with the Israelis. This is a titanic change, even during your time in the Senate, don't you think?
Absolutely. And the vote we had last week, the two Bernie Sanders pieces of legislation that would prevent sales of different types of weapons to Israel, which had normally lost maybe 10. Well, the last time it was 26. This time, well over 30. There is definitely an erosion of support for Israel in the Democrat Party. Hard to imagine that this could ever be there. And for those of us who are big supporters of Israel's and believers of Israel's right to freedom and right to exist and other issues surrounding the long time conflicts there, this is troubling. I hadn't really hit the panic button until that vote last week. And then I saw this really, the anti-Israel faction is really growing within the Democrat Party, and we can't allow that to happen. And the only way to do that is to defeat people at the ballot box. I mean, that's just the way to be effective.
I know. I want you to hear Amos Hochstein, who worked for the Biden administration as energy advisor, knows the area, was asked to come in and broker some peace and agreement over with Hezbollah during the Biden years. I want you to listen to what his evaluation is. Cut five.
I want to ask you, as a Democrat, there was this extraordinary vote this past week in the Senate. 40 Senate Democrats tried to block a U.S. weapons sale to Israel. And that adds to this growing rift we have seen between your party and Benjamin Netanyahu. Do you think Democrats are going to come to regret this break in the alliance?
So I hope that it's not a break in the alliance. I think this, what it really demonstrates is for the last several years, Prime Minister Netanyahu has sacrificed Israel's interests in the United States. The most important asset that Israel has is not its military or its intelligence. It's the relation, it's the special relationship with the United States that has been bipartisan for so many decades.
So he feels as though, he went on to say, that he feels like Netanyahu became too close to the Republican Party, and therefore Democrats view Israel as a Republican appendage.
You know, I think that is a weak, weak argument for him to make. I mean, the best voice you have in the United States Senate is your vote. And for 40, I said earlier 30 because I wasn't sure of the exact number, but for 40, they only have 47 members. For 40 of them to vote against something that would be a layup in past years and to blame it all on Netanyahu, that's an easy mark for them. But I think he's trying to paper over the fact that their party has gone far afield. Does he not remember October the 7th? Does he not remember the brutality of which Israel was attacked and women were just accosted and mutilated in front of their own families? It's just astounding to me that the erosion of support for Israel is as deep as it is.
It is. It's pretty nuts. So what is going on with funding of DHS? You guys said, all right, we're not going to fund it. We're going to do it through a reconciliation package. Then everyone's putting everything into the reconciliation package when you wanted to do a somewhat small, skinny package to fund it on its own because the Democrats won't budge and this is getting to a crisis period. Your thoughts about where we stand, because the House didn't pick up where you guys left off.
No, they certainly didn't. And that was a big miss. So I would say we are going to stick to the small package theory. As far as I know, the text hasn't come out today, but it will come out today. I do know that only two committees are going to be noticed on this, which means the ability for people to load things in from, education or agriculture or anything of that nature. Well, those availabilities will not be there for them on the technical basis by the parliamentarian. So I think the plan is to move forward with this narrow focus to fund DHS. But this is not a good thing because if we're going to be yanking out parochial things out of appropriations bills because we like something or they don't like something, that to me is a bad road to go down. And I think the Democrats, we voted over 16 times to fund Homeland Security. I went through my TSA this morning. They're demoralized. Even at a small airport where the pressures aren't there, they're demoralized and wondering. And they've lost people. I mean, because people, they can't deal with the uncertainty. And so we've got to do this week to make sure that these folks get paid and know they're appreciated and that we need the security that they provide. And so I think you'll see that skinny bill come out this afternoon. And we'll proceed to that maybe on Wednesday or Thursday.
Really? And then in the House, you're going to see what they're going to do to it, because if they add a lot to it, then you're going to have to vote on it again, right?
Yeah, see what they do. You know, there's this whole theory of, oh, it's the last train to leave the station. I don't believe that's true. I think we'll have other legislative vehicles. But at the same time, we don't need to be loading anything up right now. I think we need to focus on the task at hand, and that's funding Department of Homeland Security.
What about Save America Act?
Save America Act is still alive. I mean, I'm a co-sponsor of that. Believe in the principles that it encompasses. It still has a hurdle of a 60-vote hurdle, but we haven't come to the final vote yet. A lot of people talking about it, and so I think we're going to continue that discussion as we move forward. But I think the first thing we're going to try to do is Homeland Security.
Homeland Security first, and then Save America Act after.
Yeah.
All right, and then the War Powers Act, do you feel as though Republicans are jumping ship? Do you worry about 60 days goes by and Republicans pulling the rug out?
I think that there, you know, you read that there's a group developing a Republican War Powers Act. I don't see that as a big groundswell right now. I think as time moves on, it could pick up steam. But at this point, you see that the votes are pretty much staying behind the president's right and ability to forestall the Iranian people from developing a nuclear weapon, which could harm our country deeply.
Senator Shelley Moore Capito, thanks so much, Senator.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Brian.
You got it. 1-866-408-7669. Back in a moment.
Newsmakers and newsbreakers. Hear it first on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
The results, I say, speak for themselves. If the fake news mafia isn't hitting you personally with baseless information in Washington, D.C., then you're not doing your job. And it's louder than ever because this FBI, under President Trump's brilliant leadership and backing the blue and backing law enforcement, this FBI has the most prolific year in crime reduction in United States history. A 20% reduction in the homicide rate, a 20-point drop in opiate overdose deaths. We have found and identified 6,300 child victims, 6,300 kids get to go home to their kids. That's a 30% increase. And Maria, I'm happy to announce on your show that we are not going to take this laying down. You want to attack my character? Come at me. Bring it on. I'll see you in court.
So you're going to sue them?
Absolutely. It's coming tomorrow.
So that is Kash Patel. Generally responding to the Atlantic article, which really skewered him, said that, you know, he was on his computer, he got locked out, he thought he was fired, that he disappears and drinks too much. So the Atlantic was never written a positive story, obviously involved in the whole Signal chat, mistakenly putting Goldberg onto that conversation, costs Michael his job, Walt's his job, and put him over to the UN. But having said that, so we'll see with Kash Patel. I mean, people are definitely out to get him. He definitely got to the place. There's definitely some revenge out there. But let's see. If you're going to sue, that's going to have a discovery. That's going to have a discovery portion of it. He will welcome that, I believe. So we'll see what happens. One thing is the FBI is functioning at an extremely high rate. People like to be critical of Secretary of War. Tell me something that our military has not done, which has been off the wall fantastic. Speaking of wall, Mark Wahlberg speaking out to Fox News Digital. He's got a new movie coming out. He was talking about basically being famous since his 20s and now trying to raise a family in normalcy. Here's what he said about keeping his kids grounded. Cut 41.
They know Dad's just a regular guy. It just happens to be my job. You know, there are pros and cons to it, right? I mean, if they want to meet somebody, there's a good chance I could make it happen. But there's also a lot of baggage that comes with it, you know? You know, I just try to stay as connected to them as possible and be just a normal dad.
Well, he is normal dad, but he's got Wahlburgers too, which also brings additional fame, gets free hamburgers, but it's a very successful franchise. He does with his other brother, and then he's got another brother that's famous on a detective show. What is that? I'm sure it's their number one show, isn't it? Yeah, Blue Bloods. Oh, that's off the air now, isn't it? Oh, it's off the air. But that he had a great run there, and I think they both started as rappers.
Yeah, they did. I think they both start singing, one start acting, then music. I don't remember, but you know.
Yeah, I do have one more thing to bring up. That again, it's not nearly a shot at Gen Z, but I just then you know the quiet quitting. Everyone said quietly, people just quit. They don't make a big deal of it. They just don't work anymore. Now Gen Z's got this other thing they're doing. And soft off days. It's a new trend. The idea of taking soft off days when you work a day to do just about anything else, Make sure you don't do that job. It's a new phenomenon. Videos across social media instruct employees on their best way to take a soft day off while assuaging any guilt. Employers might see it as wasting company time, but many people believe soft off days are harmless and even needed. So-called time theft, the practice of running errands or doing personal matters during work when you're on the clock. That's a soft off day.
I think it's a little bit of nonsense, to be honest with you.
From consciously long lunch breaks to Botox appointments during work hours, many workers are increasingly view this practice as crucial to their work-life balance. How do you feel about that? Is this a good way to get work-life balance?
No, I think it's actually totally fair, to be honest with you, because A, we are now always on. There's not really a work day, right? People are responding to emails and doing things at all hours. It's not as if most people work a 9-to-5. So, you know, if you can throw in a load of laundry or do things in the middle of the day, but you're still responding to things, and then you're still responding at 8 p.m., if you're getting it done, what's the problem?
Well, I mean, you could say, I want my work to be done. But I think that if you go to work and you're, you know, doing errands and things, and then you don't get a promotion, don't you think they're related? I mean, and when you're in your 20s, it's really hard to have work-life balance. You are you are laying the foundation for having a quality of life later.
That is true. I think it also depends on your industry. But yes, like in your 20s, when you're working your butt off, taking the crappy shifts.
Yeah, you don't really worry about balance. It's traditionally the way it's happened. That's just the way you do it. First guy in, the interns always get the worst jobs. The first person in always get the worst jobs. You graduate up. Employees who feel underpaid for their quality of work, 70%. So that's your way of taking a soft day off. You don't appreciate me? Well, I'll just take my time. I'll pick up my laundry. I'll buy socks during the day. What do you think about it? BrianKilmeade.com. Tell me what you think, and I'll read out your answers tomorrow. Soft days off. Keep it here.